Tackle. And, of course, it is March 16th, and this is Spiritual on Week 11. Ha! All right, good. So we're in chapter 6, verses 1 through 12. Four more roles will be addressed today, actually. Four, verses 1 through 9. So for those first roles, we're going to look at verses 1 through 4. Someone want to read for me just verses, 1, all by its lonesome, I guess. Someone read that, please.
Children, obey your parents because you belong to the Lord, for this is the right thing to do.
All right, he's addressing those who are minors, not necessarily, the word children there means minor, under 18. And what's the role of a child? What are they called to do?
Obey.
Notice, this is obey. This is really important. Much different than wives, not called to obey husbands. Children are called to obey. Who are they called to obey?
Parents.
Ah, now what's the verse say? Look at the verse closely. Children, obey your parents. Because
you belong to the Lord.
The words there actually are the same as in earlier, because you're considered to be part of God's family, you need to obey your parents as if you're obeying the Lord, because you belong to the Lord. Now, remember, this is all sort of connected. You children need to obey your parents as if you're obeying the Lord. So you may not agree with your parents, you may not always like what they say, but what are you called to do? You're called to obey it, to do it. Now, what's the problem with that? If you have children who are Christians and parents who are not, then what are the children called to do?
Still obey.
Still obey, yes. As unto the Lord. Now, once again, this is similar to the wives and husbands. If the other spouse is not a believer, doesn't change the role, unless they are calling you to do something that's against God's commands. So God's always the highest authority, but if a husband or wife or parent, you know, is in line with the majority of God's authority, then you obey regardless. But the only time you get to disobey is if the parent is telling you to do something that's against God's will or against God's commands. Now, that's not spelled out here, but that's implied that God's always the top authority. But in the majority of things, and that's going to be like 95% of the time, children obey your parents in the Lord. That's what it says. And notice it's obey. Does it say you get to question and challenge? And what's the word say?
Obey.
This is not a negotiation. This is not a... Now, wise parents will sometimes explain the rules to the kids, but the ultimate authority comes back to children, obey your parents in the Lord, or because you belong to the Lord. Why is this going to be a big deal for Paul? Because this is the root of all society, if you think about it. That's why he gets the verses 2 and 3. So I'm going to read those for me.
Honor your father and mother. This is the first commandment with a promise. If you honor your father and mother, things will go well for you, and you will have a long life for yourself.
Now he's quoting from the Big Ten. The Big Ten of the Old Testament are what? Where's he quoting from? The Ten Commandments, Exodus chapter 20. And what's interesting is, which commandment is he quoting? That's the fifth commandment. Honor your father and mother. Okay, now if you know your Ten Commandments, what are the first four? The first four, now I'm not expecting you to recite them because, you know, I'd be pretty proud of you if you could. But the first four commandments are all about your relationship with God. Vertical. It's don't have any other gods before me. Don't make any graven images. Keep the Sabbath. All that, right? Don't use the Lord's name in vain. It's our human relationship with the divine, with God. Vertical. Starting with with commandment 5, they're all the horizontal commands. How do we deal with each other? There are 6 of those. Why is it interesting that the first one is parents? The first of those 6 commandments is honor your father and mother. God thinks so highly of this one that he puts it first in that list of 6. Because it's the fundamental, the foundation of everything else. Over and over again in Scripture, you see parents, that whole family relationship is the building block of everything else. In other words, what God kind of says to Moses is, you got to tell them to honor their father and mother before they can learn not to bear false witness, before they can learn not to commit adultery, before they can learn not to steal. In other words, this one is the first because it's the foundation. It's the first one that Moses expressed to the people. And Paul says it's also the first commandment with a promise. What's the promise? Yeah, that it will go well with you. It doesn't necessarily promise chronological years. It just promises sort of a blessed life, a good life. A long life is kind of a It's an interpretation, but it's just meaning a solid, things will go well with you. Because if you honor your parents, what does that start you out with in life? A very good understanding of how to respect adults, how to learn from adults. Even though you may not agree with them, you honor them. And that can really set you up for a lot of good relationships in the rest of your life. Your workplace, your family relationships, everything else. So Paul's kind of saying what the Old Testament says. This is a pretty important foundational command. It goes hand in hand with obey. Notice verse 1 is obey your parents. That's addressed to children who are minors. Verse 2 is honor your parents. When does that one expire?
Never.
Well, you know, what about if your parents aren't with you anymore? Are you still commanded to honor them? Yes, you are. Now, it's different. When your parents are gone, you can still honor them by honoring their memory. You can still honor them by talking about them and sharing the lessons they taught you and sharing the pictures and the memories and even visiting the gravesite. And you can pass on so much of the heritage by honoring your father and mother. Even if they've been gone for decades, you can still honor them by making them part of your life on a regular basis. And that's still very much, I think, in play throughout our lives. You can honor your parents even after they're gone. What does it mean to honor? We've been talking about this. What's it mean to honor? What's the biblical word honor mean?
High regard.
High regard. My helpful hint number 3 happens to tell you. Yeah. Yes. To give weight to give value to. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to agree with all the time, but you're going to take seriously what they say. You're going to give weight to, you're going to give consideration to. You're going to honor them by listening to them, by considering, by thinking about. And in some cases, you may decide to do something different, but you're still going to give them the consideration because they are your parents. They deserve that honor. Does that make sense? So children are commanded to obey. We're all commanded to honor. Honor your parents, your father and mother, as in the Lord. It's the first commandment that comes with a promise. You'll have good, long life. Why is Paul hitting this so hard? Because this role goes on for your entire life. If you're a child or if you're a parent, this is something that'll be part of your life for a long time. Make sense?
Well, it's the foundation of worship, too. God is the Father. It makes sense that
that's right.
Yes,
it makes sense for the idea of worship as well, because God sets up a family of faith, and in a sense, you'll have parents in the faith, people who may have led you to Christ, people who have influenced you spiritually, that while they're not biological parents, God may have put mentors in your life or people who've helped you, or you may be a mentor or someone who has spiritual influence over others. The same concepts can be applied to that, to the family of faith as well as the family of biology. Does that make sense? So it's good foundational stuff, and Paul's saying this is the building block of society, but it's also the building block of the church. He's kind of saying this is important to note regardless of what situation you find yourselves in. And it's so interesting to me that in lists of the end times, there's one in 2 Timothy chapter 3, I think I put in your helpful background notes even, one of the sins that's listed as the society, as the world begins to spin apart, fall apart, along with all these horrible sins, is listed disobedience to parents. Disobedience to parents. Because that's when it starts breaking down, is when people start disobeying parents and disintegrating the family unit, and then how long to the society begins to fall apart. So Paul's saying this is an important one. This is crucial to the future. This is crucial to the family, not only just the biological family, but the church. Questions, comments, knock knock jokes? The idea is you can still honor your parents regardless of when, and if you have children or grandchildren, obedience is going to be what's required of them. This is not always easy, as you know, but this is what's required. Verse 4 deals with the other role that some of you have experienced, parents. It says fathers, but the Greek word can actually mean parents. Someone read verse 4, please.
Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger by the way you treat them.
Now, of course, from personal experience, I can share with you that nobody can push my buttons better than my father or my parents in general. But because why? Why is it important for parents not to exasperate or frustrate their children? Because you know them better than anybody else, right? You know the way they're wired. You've seen them from, you know, day one, and you know what their triggers are, what their buttons are. And you know that even when you parent, and even when you are, you know, trying to be the best you can, there's times you're going to do stuff that frustrates and exasperates them. And sometimes, let's face it, we're human, and we don't always respond well. And I love the fact that Paul calls us to not exasperate or frustrate our children. Because we all know how to tweak their buttons and pull their little strings. And even as you're an adult, you know that still happens. And Paul's calling for restraint and self-control. And instead, again, the whole put off this behavior and put on what he's supposed to put on. Parents, don't exasperate or frustrate your children, but instead... Yeah, the way you bring them up. And notice the words used. You are to discipline and instruct. Yes, as the Lord has taught you. Those are important words. Discipline means to train, and that's more of an active pursuit, an active training. It's you. It's more of a word that tells you how to, you may show instead of telling, but it's the discipline. It could mean punishment, but it also can mean training, as in active teaching, showing them how to do things. Instruction is passing on information. So both of those are crucial. You're to discipline and instruct, and the way you're to do that is not from your own knowledge, not from your own resources, but from the Lord. You have plenty of information from the Lord. You have plenty of action that you've learned from the Lord. You're to pass that on to your children. You're to use that as your foundation for parenting. Or in this case, you can also apply this in spiritual terms, mentoring and discipling and helping in the church. It could mean, Paul's meaning biological family here, but it could also mean within the church as well. Questions? Why is this an important thing for him to talk about?
If it's coming from the Lord, then it is laced with love.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have heard some people say that when they were being parented, it was like parents were imparting information to them.
Right.
As you might find in a disciplined classroom or something. Mm-hmm. And that certainly would be apart from the love aspect.
Mm-hmm. And the idea is this is from the Lord, so it's going to be filled with grace as well. Grace and love, and yes, structure, and yes, boundaries, and yes, sometimes consequences for wrong choices. But think about the way God parents us. How much does he, you know, think about the ways God parents us. How many times is he impatient with you? Never. How many times does his grace run out, or his love run out, or his mercy run out? Never. Now, of course, we're humans, so we're going to have our limitations. But what Paul's saying is, trust the Lord enough to let him be the power source of your parenting. Trust the Lord enough to let your self-control flow from the fruit of the Spirit, from the Spirit, not from your own resources. Because let's face it, at the end of a long day of parenting, you know, if you've hung out with a 2-year-old long enough, your self-control is not going to last very long. The idea is you can't do this in your own strength. You've got to allow the Lord's strength to flow through you. And you parent as the Lord parents. You discipline and you train as the Lord would have you to do. It's one verse that means a whole lot. I love the fact that, you know, the parents get one verse. Because Paul's saying, yes, it's complicated. Yes, it's a lot of work. But it can be summed up in one verse. It doesn't need 6 verses or 10 verses or a whole chapter. I wish there was more. But what Paul's saying is it really comes down to trusting God's power to flow through you, discipline and training. This is all you need right here. Don't push their buttons. Don't mess with them intentionally. But instead, put on, you know, the things that will help you, which is discipline and train your children as the Lord. Questions, comments?
I think it's just important that parents are seen as following the example of God. So mm-hmm. You do have to live that, too, and be an example mm-hmm. for your children.
Yeah, it's huge. One of the things that meant the most to me when I was growing up is my dad especially was really good at acknowledging when he was wrong, when he just blew it. When there was one famous incident that happened, we were on vacation. My dad rarely lost his temper, but when he did, yeah, you would know it. I mean, we 4 children, he'd been stuck in a car with us for a day and a half, and we got to the vacation place, and we were just out of control. We were just going nuts, and he just came in, and he slammed the door, and he broke the door. That's how hard he slammed the door. And at that moment, we were like, ooh! And You know, we better get serious. Dad just broke a door. He's going to break one of us next. We better, you know. And later, he actually came to us and he apologized for that outburst of anger and how that was a sinful sort of where he crossed the line. Now, he didn't say that he was to blame for what we had done wrong. He fully acknowledged that we had kind of overstepped our boundaries and were being total punks. But he said so what he taught us was sometimes parents make mistakes. Sometimes parents are wrong. And he showed us that it's good and healthy sometimes to admit that you were wrong. And he essentially taught us in other situations it is necessary to ask for forgiveness of each other when you do wrong. And so, you know, that as a parent, that's a huge example. Now, obviously, if you're parenting from a fear-based sort of thing where your kids have to be afraid of you, you're never going to admit you're wrong. But if you're parenting from a God-based security, then it's going to be healthy and good to admit that you're wrong every now and then when you are wrong, and sometimes to ask for forgiveness. You know, I don't know if that makes sense, but it's an important model that God's going to reward. If we live it out in front of kids and grandkids, it's an important reality. And I think a lot of times we have parental roles, even if you're not a parent. You have parental roles. I have a lot of influence with my niece and nephew, and that's sometimes pretty scary. But I think we have parental roles with kids in the church, with grandkids, with friends' kids. So take opportunities that God gives you and live them wisely, even if you don't necessarily have the children of your own or your own biological grandchildren. You still have a lot of influence, if that makes sense. Any other comments? Let's move on to the next role, verses 5 through 9. Five through 8 is what we're going to look at. Let's read 5 and 6.
Slaves, obey your earthly masters with deep respect and fear. Serve them sincerely as you would serve Christ.
All right, the concept of slaves. This is a little uncomfortable if you don't understand the background. What type of slavery existed in the first century? Because when I say slavery, you automatically think American context of slavery, where one race was oppressed by another, and they were enslaved for their entire lives. Their children were slaves. They were snatched and stolen from Africa, brought to the New World, enslaved for permanently. Is that what this is?
No.
Nope. Why is this important? Because you need to understand the context of it. They were economic situations where they were indentured servants. If you had a debt, you wouldn't declare bankruptcy. You would go to work for the person you owed the debt to. If you were captured militarily, you could be a slave. If you were somehow your family got in trouble, you could become a slave. It was not a permanent condition, and your children or grandchildren were not enslaved as well. And it sometimes was a temporary thing, and it was almost an economic institution more so than a racial-based institution. So, important to know that, because when he talks about slaves, you can actually translate this into modern context of workers and bosses. It's okay to do that. Employees, workers, or supervisors and bosses. It's okay to do that translation in your head. That may help a little bit. Because when he says in verse 5, slaves, what's their role with their masters?
Obey.
Once again, it's obey. It doesn't say question, challenge, discuss. It says you do it. You do it. If your boss or supervisor tells you to do something, you do it. And your attitude should be with
respect.
Yeah, fear and trembling is actually what it says too, right? It depends on your translation. It's actually with awe and respect, with honor and respect, essentially. So when you do it, you got to assume that sometimes the boss knows more than you do at times, which I know is hard sometimes. But the reality is it's part of the system that God sets up of submission. Remember, we talked about submission being throughout our lives. And sometimes as an employee, you got to submit to the boss. Even if you don't always agree or don't understand, your job is to submit and follow. And then to obey. Obey what they tell you to do. And in this case, he's talking to slaves in the first century. That would have been an important concept because the Romans did allow slaves to be punished for disobedience. Masters were encouraged to treat their slaves well. You had tons of laws regarding the treatment of slaves. And the only time they could really be punished is if they openly disobeyed their master. And so that was part of their day and age. What else does it say there in verses 5 and 6? Slaves should obey their masters as unto the Lord, once again. What's that about? So what should be their attitude? Yeah. Think about this for a second. If you're an employee, a worker, and you have a choice of how your attitude can be in the workplace, right? So your boss tells you to do something, you don't want to do it. But what happens if your attitude is something you choose and you do it with grace and goodness and a willingness to help? If you're willing to serve and love, and even in those situations, you're willing to shine the light of Christ, what can that do? It transforms your workplace. It can influence your boss. It can influence your coworkers. One of the biggest witnesses that we Christians can have is in the world around us as we interact with people. And this is one of those key roles in a workplace. In a workplace. So what's Paul calling us to? He's calling us to an attitude that will reflect Christ working in us. Make sense? Anything else in verse 5 or 6 trigger your interest? Oh, we haven't read 6. Do you mind reading it? Just read 5 and 6 again, please.
Try to please them all the time, not just when they are watching you. As slaves of Christ, do the will of God with all your heart.
Now, you should try to work hard and please them when? Only when they're observing you, right? When they're not observing you, you can kick back, take a nap, no big deal. Why does he mention that? It's the power of a good work ethic. If you have a good work ethic, it's going to be an amazing testimony and witness, because if they're watching you and you just work hard, then what is that actually doing? You're showing that you're lazy and kind of, you're only going to work if someone's pressuring you. You're only going to really do the job if someone's watching you. The rest of the time, I don't really care. What kind of witness is that? What he's saying is the power of a Christian work ethic. This concept gets developed hundreds of years later, and becomes known as the Protestant work ethic. This is what built our country in many ways. The idea that you do a good job regardless of if you get rewarded, regardless if anyone notices, regardless if you get any attention whatsoever, you do a good job because your ultimate boss is God. And so you're working as unto the Lord, and your job is going to bring God glory regardless if you get any credit or not. You're going to get God some credit, and that's your ultimate reward. Does that make sense? So what Paul is calling for is that kind of attitude, that regardless of whatever you do it as unto the Lord, and you do it for the glory of the Lord. And you may or may not get credit for it. You may or may not get that promotion. You may or may not get the bonus. That's not what's important. It is the ultimate reward for God is the important part.
I like in verse 5, too, that serve them sincerely.
Yes. Yes. Yes, because, again, if you're just doing it because you're afraid of the consequences or afraid of getting fired or afraid of whatever, that's not a good motivation. That's going to shine through. If you're doing it because you're trying to do a good job and because you're trying to honestly work hard and honestly, that creates a great impression. That creates a great witness in so many ways. Questions? Comments? Most of you are going, thank goodness we're retired. We don't have to worry about this work thing anymore. And by the way, you're welcome for me paying your Social Security. No problem. I'm working on that. Verses 7 and 8.
Work with enthusiasm as you were working for the Lord rather than for people. Remember that the Lord will reward each one of us for good to do, whether you are slaves or free.
What should be your attitude according to verse 7? Work with... Now, what's that word mean? Because it doesn't necessarily mean you jump up and down like some cheerleader on caffeine. What does it mean? The great thing about this word is it comes from the root word enthuo, which means in God's energy. I like that. That's where the root word enthusiastic comes from. It comes from in God's energy. So in thuo, think about that for a moment. If you work in God's energy, what kind of attitude are you going to have? What kind of work ethic are you going to have? What kind of difference could that make? So he's saying, work with enthusiasm as if you're working for God, because really, you are. Whatever you do, and this is an important concept. It's not just ministry that's a vocation that's unto the Lord. It's not just my job. Yes, I work for the church, and yes, I get paid to do amazingly awesome things like teach the Bible. But every vocation is a ministry. Every work you do can be a witness to the Lord, can be, regardless of what it is. If you're a plumber and you happen to be a Christian and you work as if you're working for the Lord with good integrity, with a hard work ethic, with delivering on what you promise, showing up on time, communicating well, think about that for a moment. Think about if the service people that came to your house, if the, let's say, cable and phone people that came to your house, think about if you had a Christian with that kind of work ethic. What witness could that make? Think about the people that work in restaurants and work in your doctor's offices, and think about the witness that could be created if people, think about those IRS agents that we all love so much. Now all of a sudden you start thinking, what a difference could be made if people worked with good attitudes, and if they were, that could really make a huge amount of difference, right? That's what Paul's calling for. Verse 7, work enthusiastically. And what's the rest of that verse say into 8? Because verse 8 can be kind of tricky if you're not careful. What does verse 8 seem to say?
The Lord will reward each one.
Yeah. Not what it seems to say. What it actually says is the Lord will reward each one for what they've done. Be careful not to take that out of context. This is not works righteousness. This is not if you do good deeds, God will. What is he saying in this verse? He's saying if you go about it with the right attitude, with the right work ethic, with the right, regardless if you get rewards on this earth or not, God notices. Regardless if you get that promotion or not, God notices. Your work in this world is significant, regardless of whether you get rewarded or not. That your vocation, that your dedication, that your service, even in the church, even if nobody ever knows what you've done in this church or in this community or in this world, God knows. God knows. And that's comforting, isn't it? Even if you never get that promotion or never get that bonus or never get that public acknowledgement, even if no one ever notices what you did or mentions it or thanks you, God notices. God notes it. And God will reward. That's a comforting and reassuring statement. Questions on that? Don't get that mixed up now with your faith, salvation by faith stuff. But verse 9 is one verse that addresses masters or supervisors or bosses. Someone read that for me.
Masters, treat your slaves in the same way. Don't threaten them. Remember, you both have the same master in heaven, and he has no favorites.
Masters, treat your slaves in the same way. What does that mean?
With respect,
exactly. With respect, with honor, with understanding that your employees, your slaves are important, are significant, are made in God's image. They're worth your respect. They're worth your good treatment. And notice what the rest of verse 9 says. What's the reasoning behind this? Yeah, because ultimately you have a boss too. You know, ultimately each and every one of us has a higher authority that we need to make sure we're always aware of. We're not the ultimate boss. Even if you're the head of a company, the CEO, you still have someone above you. And that perspective is important to keep in mind, because we talk about how absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's what happens with us humans. When we think we're in charge, when we think we're the ultimate power, so often we make mistakes, so often we let that get to our head. And Paul's kind of saying, just remember, you do have a boss, and you do have accountability, and God's going to hold you accountable for how you treated those who you were responsible for, be it a workplace, be it whatever. That's going to be something that's important. Questions, comments? Why do the bosses only get one verse? Come on, that doesn't seem fair. We employees get 4, the slaves get 4, the bosses get 1. What's up with that? Once again, Paul's saying it's pretty simple. If you're going to be a boss, just like parents, it's pretty simple. You got to follow what the Lord tells you. It comes down to respect. It comes down to honoring. And it comes down to the reality that, you know, you got to keep in mind that this, you too have an ultimate boss, and you too have ultimate authority over you. So that's enough. Enough said. Comments, questions? Alrighty then, that's the end of your rolls, believe it or not. Verse 10 moves into a beginning of a closing section. I only know that because what's the first couple words of verse 10? And you all cheer going, finally, yes, we're near it. And Paul's going, yeah, I got about 15 more verses, but I'll say finally. So never believe it when Paul says finally, because it's never going to be quite finally. So just like if you're around someone who uses when they're praying, and sometimes they'll say in Jesus' name, or they'll pause, and you think, oh, they're coming to the end. And then, nope, that was just sort of a transition into something else. I used to have a friend that would pause in his prayers, and I could never tell when the pause was like, okay, I'm done, it's time for you to pray, Brian, or if he's just thinking, you know. So we actually had to develop a code word where he would actually, you know, he'd actually say a code word when he was ready to be done. Because otherwise we could never tell, because he's such a slow thinker. He'd have to stop and pause. And we'll never believe Paul when he says finally, because that's not really the way it works. Verse 10, someone want to read it for me? In all of these roles you just did, can you do them in your own strength? No. Can you do them by your own effort? No. Paul is saying, I'm finished talking about the roles, but in all of these things, just like in the rest of the book of Ephesians, you have to be strong in the Lord in order to get this done. And be strong means be energized, remember? This is the idea of being energized in the Lord's power. You can't do this in your own strength. You have to rely on the Lord's strength to help you. Be energized in the Lord. That's the way you can get all this done. That's the only way. Be strong in the Lord, and what else? In his mighty power. Once again, we have that great word in dunamis. It comes from the word dunamis, which means explosive power. It's where we get dynamite from and dynamic. So Paul's saying the source of your power cannot be your own strength. It's not going to last very long. The source for your power cannot be you, because you're not going to have much. Your source for your power needs to be God's power. It's unlimited, it's explosive, it is ultimately going to help you do this very difficult thing, living up to the calling that's on your life. Being a child of God, being a child of the light, that's going to be tough to do. God can help you do it. If you are strong in the Lord and you allow Him to empower you, that's the only way this is possible. I know I've said that a million times, but I think it's so important. Because we sometimes read the Bible and we're like, okay, that's it. I know what to do now. I'm just going to try harder. I'm going to work at this. And then within a short time, we're discouraged and we're frustrated. It's because we're trying to do it in our own strength. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. Verse 11, please.
Put on all of God's armor so that you will be able to stand firm against all strategies of the devil.
Put on all of God's armor. We're going to get into that specifically next time when we finish chapter 6. But why are we to put on all of God's armor? And why is it not? Why don't we get our own armor?
Because it doesn't work.
Because it doesn't work. Exactly. It doesn't work. The only way we have success is when we put on God's armor. Because that's what's going to be successful. Not our own efforts, not our own righteousness, not our own anything. We have nothing apart from Christ. We don't have it. Even though we sometimes want to and think we can accomplish it, it doesn't work. So we're to put on God's armor, and then we're to attack, right? We're to really be active, and we're to just go after, what's it say?
Stand firm.
Stand firm. We'll get into this next time, but the idea is we Christians so often forget. Our job is to understand the battle belongs to the Lord, and so often He just wants us to stand firm, not retreat, not back up, but we don't need to necessarily charge forward and win the battle either. He's just saying, I want you to be my witness. And the job of a witness is to do what? To share what you've seen, what you've experienced. That's all a witness does. The witness doesn't have to win the court case, right? The witness is not the prosecuting attorney or the defense attorney or anything else, or the judge. The witness just shares what they know, what they saw, what they heard, what they experienced. That's the job of a witness. What's the job of a light? You're to be a light. What's the job of a light? You just shine there. That's all you do, is just to reflect, just to shine. God takes care of the rest. You don't have to convict people of sin. You don't have to bring them into the kingdom. You don't have to persuade them into believing. You don't have to do any of that. God does that. So your job is just to be a witness, just to be a light, just to stand firm. That's so much what we need to do, and so often we forget that. And then we get discouraged because we're either not charging forward or we're retreating. And God's going, I just told you to stand firm. Stop getting confused. Questions on that? Anything else on verse 11?
Is it God's armor and not our armor? Because if it's God's armor, it protects us from Satan who's reaching us on the inside.
Ah.
We don't have any metal armor or any kind of human armor that can protect us on the inside.
Right, right. Yeah, that's definitely part of it. And I think he's also, Paul knew his Old Testament really well. And if you think about armor in the Old Testament, can you think of a story where someone would try to put on someone else's armor?
David.
Yeah. David, when he was going up against Goliath, do you remember the story? David was going to fight Goliath and Saul said, oh, let me give you the best armor ever made. It's the king's own armor. And when David put it on, what was the reality? It was way too big for him. David was a teenager. Saul was a grown man and very tall. The armor didn't fit him. And David eventually did what? He went forth in the armor of the Lord. And what kind of armor did he have? Human-wise, he had no armor, right? So yes, God's armor is not going to be the same as human armor. Human armor is going to protect you from, let's say, human weapons, human devices, human... But God's armor is going to protect you from everything. Spiritual attack, every form of attack, God's armor is going to be effective. Human armor is pretty limited when you think about it. And did people die with human armor? Yeah, they died all the time because human armor is flawed. It's not going to be perfect. And in David's case, it would have been more of a hamper and a hindrance to him than a help. If you think about it, what would have happened if he tried to go forth in Saul's armor? Would have tripped and fallen and gotten all messed up and not been effective at all. That's the point. Stand firm in God's armor, because if you try to stand firm in your own armor, not so much. It's not going to work. Questions, comments? Now my favorite verse, verse 12.
For we are not fighting against flesh and blood enemies, but against evil rulers and authorities of the unseen world.
Why is this important? Because when we think we're fighting against humans... We think we can do it. We think we can do it, and we get really kind of mean and nasty when you think about it, because we humans tend to go to the lowest common denominator, and the reality is we just get kind of nasty and not so good. And Paul's point is you don't hate the person. You don't hate the person. You remember what Jesus did and what Jesus taught was you love the person and you hate the sin. That's really hard to do, but Jesus models it pretty well. He spends time with people who are sinners, doesn't condone what they're doing necessarily, but he spends time with them, shows them they're valuable, shows them they're just like we're called to do. And in this case, we're to understand the battle's not against the people. The battle's against the influence behind the people, the forces behind the people. And that's a much bigger picture when you think about it, and much more beyond your ability to handle. Go ahead.
I was going to say, it's a battle for our own lives.
That's right. That's right. It's a battle for your own lives, not just a small little skirmish. This is a bigger, much bigger perspective. And Paul's saying, when you understand the reality, you're going to know you can't do it in your own strength. And so you shouldn't even try. The battle's not against flesh and blood. It's not about some sort of, you know, military antagonistic whatever. This is a much bigger picture. This is a battle of spiritual forces and quite a bit beyond you. So you can't do this in your own strength. You got to rely on God. And what's he described? This is not a battle against flesh and blood. It's a battle against? Yeah. Who's he talking about there? Satan and the boys. Yep. The fallen angels. The devil and his minions. It's not a battle against a certain person or a certain... Now, in his day and age, the focus is on the Romans. And the Roman emperor was not always a nice guy. There were some really bad Roman emperors, if you know your history at all. And Paul's kind of going, they're not the ultimate enemy. The forces behind them is the ultimate enemy. The satanic influence that's in some culture, some governments, that sort of stuff. That's what you have to realize is behind all this. So if you just take out a person, that's not really going to matter. It's what's behind them. That's the point. It's against a much bigger picture than sometimes we want to make it. Make sense? That's why it's so important to stand firm in the armor of God, because we're not, And it also prevents us from getting into those times when the church gets in trouble because we make it all about a certain person or a certain movement, and we want to just get violent and vicious. And Paul's going, no, remember, it's not about that person. It's not about let's work against that person. It's the influence behind. It's not so much about that flesh and blood. It's about the evil forces that are in this world. Comments?
God created all this dark side too, right?
Yes, and that's what's hard to understand sometimes. God allows this dark side to have power. He allows this dark side to have influence. For whatever reason, he created everything. And then, yes, knew full well that, one-third of the angels, the Old Testament talks about, would fall, would rebel with Lucifer. Remember what Lucifer means in Greek? Angel of light. Lucifer means angel of light. Lucifer was one of the archangels, one of the highest level of angels, and was known as angel of light. And yet he rebelled because he wanted more than just the place he had been given. He wanted ultimate power, ultimate control. So he rebels against God. And the Old Testament doesn't clearly teach us this, but implies that a third of the angels went with them. And God allowed that. God, you know, allows them to have influence still. I don't know why. You can ask him when you... Yes. And they're still under the ultimate authority of God and of Christ. That's not going to change. That's the ultimate, and the ultimate destiny is already decided. It's just how long it'll take to get there is what we're waiting on.
And they do a lot of damage.
And they do a lot of damage while they're here. Exactly. Go ahead.
10:16.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And all of us have the Holy Spirit living in us. So you have essentially the ultimate weapon on your side already. And that's pretty amazing when you think about it. Comments, questions? How about I pray and then you have a couple extra minutes because, yeah, my voice is starting to give out. So you all can celebrate that. My voice is starting to go. So let's pray. God, we thank you for this opportunity. We thank you for the reality that this world is under control, under your power, under your influence, and that you give us this unlimited power source known as the Holy Spirit to access your mighty power, that we don't have to do this alone. We don't have to fight alone. We don't have to be alone. That you help us understand that the battle is not against flesh and blood, but it's against this spiritual influences in the world, the evil that's out there. And we know, Lord, that you ultimately will defeat that evil. You have defeated it. And in the meantime, we get to rely on you to give us the strength to get through. Thank you for the promise of your word that we don't have to stand alone or in our own strength, but you give us your strength every step of the way. We ask your blessing in this time, and in your name we pray. Amen.